Hello, and welcome back to another edition of Blitz Scalable Venture Deals. I'm Chris Yeh, and I'm joined by my partner, Scott Johnson of Blitz Scaling Ventures. Say hey, Scott.
Hello, everyone.
All right, we're going to have to go quickly because the venture industry is busier than ever. We are looking at deals that were announced in February of 2022, and we hit an all-time high with 190 deals that were announced. That's pretty remarkable.
It is a lot. I think we have a new data source coming in that we hadn't been using before. So maybe we're seeing a few more deals than we used to. I'm not sure it's entirely apples to apples, but it also is true that it's extraordinarily busy right now. And this is despite a market decline, Chris. What do you think about that?
Well, let's not forget that announcements sometimes trail the actual financings. But I do get a sense out there that deals are still getting done. People are still taking meetings, they're starting to do it in person, despite the fact that there's been a market decline, despite the fact that there's more uncertainty in the market, people still seem eager to put money into startups.
Do you think pricing has come down, or do you have a point of view on that? I haven't seen enough deals to know whether pricing is coming down. I know there's a lot of deals happening, but it's hard to know if current pricing is affected by public markets. Usually you'd think so, but what I've read is that it's not.
Well, it's hard to say. Anecdotally, I have had people who are entrepreneurs say, yeah, we wouldn't be able to get the price that we got in November today, even though our company is a bit bigger. And I think that that is a reflection of the markets. Again, that is purely anecdotal. But the fact is, the valuations were pretty darn high before. And even if they come down, in the end, what really matters is the final valuation when you exit or go public versus the interim valuations along the way.
I hear you. There's a lot of hand-wringing about, oh, the market's come way down. I'm like, well, it's still higher than it was just 12 months ago. And nobody was complaining about valuations 12 months ago. Everybody thought, wow, these are great times. And so the fact is, these are still really great times. We're seeing 180 deals cross, 190 deals cross the wire. And we have nine deals to talk about today. So maybe we better get going. Actually, there's one more question I wanted to ask you, Chris. And it's just a general question, but we talk about these nine deals. You know, are these really the best of the 190? Are they the best deals, or are they just deals of a different flavor that happen to be the ones that should blitz scale? And you know, how do you draw the distinction there?
Well, let's be clear. There are two things that are true here. The first is the way we look for blitz scalability does not mean that they are the best deals. It means that they are the companies that are actually in a blitz scaling opportunity, which is to say they're in a valuable winner-take-most market and they appear to have the distribution strategy that would allow them to win that market. However, even that doesn't take into account everything. We famously do not incorporate competition into our calculations. So the fact that a company is in a space doesn't mean it's a good deal if it's got a competitor that's 10 times bigger and dominating and running away with the market. So that's why it's very important to understand that blitz scalability is not a be-all end-all metric that's just, okay, if it's above a certain level, invest. If it's below a certain level, don't invest. But the other element of it is that the companies that are not blitz scalable could still be very good. Remember, the things that power blitz scalability are primarily the winner take most market dynamic and the distribution strategy. And you can imagine a company that has poor winner take most dynamics, but is very good in almost every other way. That company could still be enormously successful. We talk about companies like Snowflake in that sense, for example. And that's absolutely fine. It's just not what we're focused on. So the fact that it's not something that we would invest in doesn't make it a bad deal. Now, that being said, as you may recall, we did an analysis way back when we got started with blitz scaling ventures that indicated that blitz scaling deals on average tend to be worth more. So even though I'm saying that blitz scaling deals aren't necessarily better than other deals, I am saying that as a class, blitz scaling deals tend to be better than other deals. So try to hold all those different contradictory facts in your mind at once.
Well, I'm also hearing you say that you better pick the winner, right? If you pick the third place company, then you're not going to get more than your share of the value. You'll probably get less.
Correct. Blitz scalability is a measure of the opportunity, not necessarily the company.
Perfect. All right, with that, let's get going. And we have a number to get through here, nine to get through. So we're going to start with Trialjectory. And that's the word trial, and then the letter J, and then Trajectory, as in trajectory. And it is a Series B, a $20 million Series B led by Insight. And if you want to find this company online, it is trialjectory.com. The URL was available. So not a surprise there, of course. And what does this company do, Chris? Why are we talking about them?
Well, we're talking about them because they fell just shy of being Blitz scalable. On our big board score, they got a 79, and of course, 80 is our threshold. So they're really, really close. What they do is something that is very important and very valuable. If you ever had the tragic circumstance of having a close friend or loved one who was diagnosed with cancer, you know that's a very difficult disease to combat. And what happens is the basic pattern of cancer treatment, at least for different cancers where they've been around for a while, is that there's what are called first-line treatments. And these are the things that you do as a standard thing. The problem is cancer is a really tough combatant. And so you perform surgery, you do radiation, you do chemotherapy, you do all these various things. And the goal is to try to eradicate as much of the cancer as possible. But if any of the cancer remains, it is the stuff that is resistant to that chemotherapy or resistant to radiation, and then it eventually comes growing back. And then you go to second line treatments, and hopefully those are effective for a while. But after a certain point, when the standard treatments have been exhausted, the only thing you can do is to try to get into clinical trials of new drugs, new therapies that might be able to take down these resistant cancer cells that have built up in your body. And historically, it is a big pain to get into these trials. How do you know that they're going on? There, of course, is a national clinical trials database, but it's this ancient technology. It's really hard to know whether you qualify or not. How do you get in touch with the physicians and hospitals and pharma companies that are running these? Oftentimes, it's a question of who you're connected to. Can you pull the strings to get in? So it's an unholy mess. And again, the funny thing is that the pharma companies are desperate to recruit people to be a part of these trials, because the sooner they can get through the trial and hopefully deliver good results, the sooner they can get the drug to the marketplace. And these drugs are patented, and patents run on a 20-year cycle from the time the application starts. So the sooner you get the drug to market, the more time you have to sell it as a patented drug and make significant profits. So as a result, this is something that is both highly desirable for the patients, highly desirable for the healthcare professionals who often get paid to help enroll people in clinical trials and to run them through the trials, and for the pharmaceutical companies that are looking to get approval and sell their goods. So this is something which absolutely should exist. Now, the big issue is it actually Blitz scalable? And the question becomes, well, Trialjectory has done this great job of building a website where you can go in, you can list your condition, it'll ask you all sorts of questions, when did your surgery occur, and so on and so forth. And it basically understands all the parameters of the trials so that you can put in your information, and it's really detailed, and it will tell you, here are the trials you qualify for, and here's how you get in touch with them. And that's great. But is there anything that prevents someone else from doing that? Yeah, it's hard to pull together that database, but it is absolutely the case that if you're a patient or a pharmaceutical company, you don't care whether somebody's using Trialjectory or something else, as long as you get into the trial you're looking for, or as long as you enroll the people you're looking for. So we really struggled to see this as a winner-take-most market, which is why it really failed to make the Blitz Scalability Index.
That's true, but it did really well on the other metrics, as many software companies do. But this one had a particularly good distribution score, and that's because of two things. One, it is true that the providers provide a wonderful channel to the actual patients, and so they can help the patient find this, what is really amounts to a search engine, a very specific narrow search engine, and help them use it. And so, once you get to the providers and the doctors, then you get to the patients in a leveraged way. And plus word of mouth on this kind of thing spreads really fast, because if there's anything that's effective in helping people treat cancer, then everybody knows about it really fast, because this is not something that you're passive about. When you get this diagnosis, it's the thing you care most about, and you're working every angle you can to combat it. So it's, it gets a really good distribution score. It just didn't quite make the winner take most test. And so we didn't give it that magical 80 score. It fell just short. So that's Trialjectory. And anything else you want to say about that, or can we move on to Novi?
Let's move on to Novi. What's Novi do?
So First of all, Novi raised a Series B. So this is a $40 million Series B led by Tiger Global. And they are a digital marketplace for chemical suppliers, but not just any chemical suppliers. They're the ones that work with the manufacturers and brands that make beauty products. And so these are just the things that smell good or make you look good. And they're really carefully vetted for, you know, the no animals were harmed sort of stuff, right? So you got to be very careful about your suppliers here. And the company essentially creates a directory of all the suppliers, makes sure they're vetted, and then helps the manufacturers and the brands select them. And so anytime you're providing this perfect marketplace of a supply chain, you are creating enormous value and you are in a winner take most situation because everybody wants to plug into that marketplace that has everybody on it. So all of the manufacturers want to find the suppliers and all the suppliers want to find the manufacturers. And so if you're either one of those, you have to plug in order to do business. And that's the kind of thing where we say you can print money for decades. So that's what they do. I wanted to give the URL, which is over to the right on my screen, and it's NoviConnect.com. So if you want to look them up, they've raised $52 million to date. And, you know, both of these Series Bs, Chris, that we've talked about, first one was 20 million, the next one's 40 million. So maybe the number of deals isn't changing, but maybe the size is changing because these, like, we've been seeing Series Bs well in excess of that. And so I wonder if there's a round size compression, not the number of rounds that we're going to see. Just early data coming in, but you know, certainly not a comprehensive survey, but possible, right? Okay, so we're going to give a 10 out of 10 for winner take most. And for viral growth and distribution, not a 10, not a 9 even. I mean, you got to go out and find all of these manufacturers and get them to sign up. It's not like you can just find them all in one place or they're going to be virally telling each other about it. It's kind of like going to be a lot of phone calls and a lot of looking. So you can certainly use the manufacturers to say, all right, who do you work with? And don't you want to get them on this network? And they'll probably hand them over. So there's, it's not like they get a zero, but I think an 8 is about the best we can do for winner take most and viral growth. And let's remind everyone that that's 58 points out of 100. If you get 10 out of 10 for both of those, you are well ahead of the game. And if you don't, if you get a 10 and an 8, well, you're well below because we don't just do a straight line cut against the score. We actually have an accelerated cut. So a 9 is much better than an 8, and 8 is much better than a 7. And if you get a 6, well, you're out of the running. So we really want to find the companies that are awesome at these things and not pretty good. And that's why we have that acceleration curve. Chris, why don't you run through the rest of the scoring on Novi?
Yeah, well, I want to just touch on the issue of viral growth and distribution just for a second, because you may ask, well, hold on, how come you guys give such high scores to a marketplace business like Airbnb? What makes it unusual or special? And the way to think about it is this: with Airbnb, we have this wonderful characteristic where buyers can become sellers and sellers can become buyers. Not so much for Novi, right? Novi is a straight up suppliers and customers side of things. So there's no bleed through. The other thing is that in the case of Airbnb, there really weren't a lot of alternatives. People who were coming onto the platform had never sold before. And so it was the sole channel through which they sold, which meant that they put a lot more emphasis on it. It was a much more powerful distribution channel. In the case of Novi, these are largely suppliers who've already been existing for a while, supplying the industry. This just makes it a little more efficient for them to connect, but they've already been finding ways to connect. So as opposed to conjuring up new business out of whole cloth, this is merely facilitating. So that's why it doesn't get as high a score. In addition to things that we mentioned already, market size, beauty products are enormous, and gross margin is also great because these are luxury products. So we gave them a 10 on both of those. We gave them an 8 on org and ops scalability. This is because part of what Novi does is ensure that you are complying with the different certifications that are necessary to sell your product, whether it is from a vendor like Sephora or a governmental certification of safety or what have you. Novi make that ability to do that makes Novi more appealing because it's not just a pure marketplace. It's a marketplace that includes an overlay of compliance, which makes it more helpful. But it does also require more staff to stay on top of things and make sure that you're actually correct about this. Add it all together and you get an 81 out of 100, which, while it sounds low, is above the magical 80 threshold.
Right. So what does that mean? Does that mean we're going to invest?
No, not quite. What it means is that we think it is interesting enough to investigate further. From here, we do a lot of the traditional kind of due diligence type activities, whether it is trying out the product in the case of consumer products, talking with customers in the case of enterprise products, talking with existing investors to find out what's going on there. But it puts them on our watch list, and it means that we will likely do some more work on this. And if we like what we see, reach out to the CEO.
Yeah. And one of the things I think I would want to look into when talking to customers is, particularly on the buyer side, you know, once they find a good supplier, are they really going to keep paying the middleman, or are they going to work around them? Is the marketplace adding enough value that once people find each other, they're going to keep using that marketplace because it's trusted, or there's a payment layer in there that's really great, or there's some sort of other sort of managed service that's going on. There's got to be a reason for people to stick around, and maybe it's because they switch suppliers a lot. I don't know, but it's something where we really would have to dig in and understand why there's all the money's going to flow through this marketplace, and they're not just going to make matches that then leave. So customer churn would be a big thing to figure out there, but it looks like
this is one
of those, you know, convinced that people are going to stick around.
And this is one of the funny things about marketplaces, right? The ideal situation is a case where the customers are making regular purchases, but never from the same vendors. Because when they purchase from the same vendors, the temptation for circumvention arrives. The value add is already created, and therefore, why do I need to keep paying in order to do that? Whereas with Airbnb, where you're not staying at the same place every year or every month, then there's no reason to circumvent. Same for eBay, right? eBay is a merchant. So all of these things make sense and helps explain why eBay and Airbnb are two of the most successful marketplace businesses of all time.
Absolutely right. So let's move on. Okay, next is vendor PM, as in PM as in afternoon, post-market. So that's a seed round. So this is a $6 million seed round, which is sort of a good old fashioned number, right? You know, we're seeing all these, like there's a $100 million seed round that happened, you know, and it's not really a seed round, but this is vendorpm.com. And who's in here? Bessemer. So Bessemer is one of the bettors on this one. And they are in Toronto, Canada. So this is a seed round. And this is another one of those deals that helps out real estate property managers and owners. And it's, if you've ever tried to manage a property or just even your own house, and you need a plumber, or you need an electrician, or you need, a carpenter, or it just, you know, how do you sort through all of the providers to find the ones that A, will do a good job, and B, have enough insurance so that you can trust that if something goes wrong, they're covered. And there's just a lot of due diligence around that. And once you find one, they're not available. So your plumbing's broken. You need somebody right away. And so you have to go and find a different one. So I think if you're just managing your house, well, that's a manageable problem. But if you're managing 50 houses or 500 houses, then boy, it'd be useful to have an entire database of all the vendors and what their capabilities are, what their insurance is. We looked at a couple other deals that have this characteristic and do help you find other vendors, but this one's in Canada, and maybe the Canada market is different. I think we have to do a lot more research on exactly what the competitive situation is here in this market. But the business model itself, Chris, looks scalable, right?
Absolutely. I mean, again, this has characteristics that are like a marketplace, much like with Novi. In fact, we gave them the same scores for winner take most and viral growth or distribution, 10 and 8. 10 and 8 is a pretty good score. We always say that the threshold you have, if you get down to 8 and 8, you can never make 80. You have to have at least 9 and 8. So 10 and 8 is pretty close. Obviously, we love people who are 10 and 10. That's the best way to get onto our radar screen. And so with vendor PM, I mean, I think this a lot of the same things apply. The score is nearly the same. The main difference is we gave it a 9 for org scalability and a 10 for ops scalability. And the reason is that it's just a lot easier. They're not dealing with all these random certifications and staying on top of it. They just have to make sure that they have gotten all the people onto the marketplace. So it's a slightly easier problem than Novi. But it has a lot of the same characteristics, which makes it a good blitzscaling prospect. It's not the most flashy that we've ever seen, but it is certainly a solid one.
And so if you want to, oh, I gave the URL out. So that's good. So we're done with that. That was a quick one. On to standard metrics. We really like this one because we're investors and this scratches a real itch that investors have, which is how do you keep track of how well your companies are doing? And how do you report that out? And do you have, like, I can't tell you how many emails I've sent to the CFO saying, could you please provide this, this, and this so we can put that in our quarterly update? And the CFO gets that same email from every other investor in the company. And if you're a founder and you just took a party round and there are 25 angels in your deal and they're all asking for information, I think what founders usually do is they sort of create a founder's letter and they send the letter out saying, here's how we're doing and here's where we could use some help. And you know, those are good. You should still do those. But what Standard Metrics wants to do is, guess what? Create standard metrics. They want everyone to track and report on their business in a standardized way so that there's a real dashboard every investor can look at and see, not exactly real time, but in fairly updated way, how their companies are doing financially and the important metrics. And but it's really the audience here is investors, but it's enormously value add for the companies too, because it prevents all of that, hey, how you doing stuff. That's essentially investor relations in a box for these companies. And by the way, the companies are also reporting that they're getting really good insights in their business because Standard Metrics is using best practices to develop their product, and not every entrepreneur is using best practices to see what's going on in their business. So there's, you know, if you're not tracking cohorts the right way and looking at churn the right way, well, Standard Metrics is going to have that for you. And so we just think this is a great idea, but I know what you're thinking, right? It's like, ooh, isn't this a small market?
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. But then we had this same issue come up before with Carta. Carta is something where back in the beginning, when it was e-shares or just cap table management, people were like, how could this possibly be big enough? And it turns out that it is because Carta has gotten into so many other things. We, for example, use Carta as the back office for our venture firm. And Carta is growing by leaps and bounds in conjunction with the overall growth of private investing in the venture capital sector. And so Standard Metrics can do something similar. And again, you know, look, the network effect it has is a platform network effect. It's not quite as strong as a two-sided marketplace or a communications network, but it's still strong enough to get it a 9. And as you mentioned, the extreme virality of various companies, various venture funds requiring all their portfolio companies to standardize on this gives it a 9 there as well. So this is a 9-9 kind of deal, 9 for winner take most, 9 for viral growth, which ironically enough is not quite as good as a 10-8 because as you remember, the higher scores are privileged. So a 10-8 actually results in a higher score than a 9-9. But it does very well on product market fit. We gave it a 9, which is unusually high, but we know this problem inside and out. We know it's there and we would love to have it solved. We just discussed the market size. We gave it a 9, not a 10, just because, you know, again, we feel like it has a Carta-like thing. Will they be able to expand? Not quite enough to give it a 10, but a 9 still. And then it is purely software. So 10 for gross margin, 10 for scalability. That gives it an 83, which again, very solid score and probably a company we're going to be a customer of, even if we do not invest.
Yeah, and this one's well targeted at a lot of our listening audience. So I'll be sure to mention the URL, which is standardmetrics.io. And you will find them there. And by the way, this was a $24 million Series A with participation from Spark and a whole bunch of others, and 8VC led it. So that's Standard Metrics. And we're halfway through. Next is Flash Food. And I think this is the easiest one to explain, so I'll do it. It's simply when food in a grocery store is about to reach its sell-by date, then grocery stores can send a flash message out to people nearby who can come in and buy it at a discount. And so this is an obvious social net, really, where it's a store is saying to as many people as possible, come and get it, it's discounted. And rather than throw away these raspberries because they're going to go bad tomorrow, you can get raspberries for $2 instead of $5. And so it's great for everybody, right? There's less food waste, there's more profit, and people spend a little less on groceries, or they get those raspberries that they otherwise wouldn't buy because they're so darn pricey. So it's just a great idea. And so it's one of those things that the handheld mobile things we all have in our pockets are changing the way we live our lives. And it's just yet another small one of those. It's a $12 million Series A, and Seed to Growth led it. That's S2G Ventures, which is some money from the Walton family. And they do a lot of make the earth better investing. General Catalyst is also in this round, which is how we heard of it. And it is flashfood.com. So if you want to find them on the web, that's where they are. Pretty easy to score this one, Chris, right?
Absolutely. So is it winner take most? Absolutely. And the reason is a combination of network effects and land grab. From a network effects perspective, obviously, as a consumer, I'm going to want to sign up for the service that has the most grocery stores on it, gives me the greatest variety. If I'm a grocery store, I want to go sign up for the one that has the most consumers on it, because guess what? I don't want to deal with five of these. I want to have one of these because it adds complexity to my operations, and just adding the one is much better than trying to add three or four. And of course, once you get the grocery store on to the platform, they're probably going to stay on the platform. It's very unlikely. They don't really have a lot of options for what to do with this expiring food. Again, let me emphasize, it's not that food cannot be eaten after the sell-by date. People often call it an expiration date. That's not true. It doesn't mean the food is bad. It just means that it cannot be sold at that point in time. So I'm a big fan of this in terms of reducing food waste, and also because I'm a cheapskate. So that's great. Now, the viral growth or distribution, is there natural virality? It's not like it's group buying or anything like that. I guess you might tell your friends, but I mean, do you really want to tell your friends when they come over to your cocktail party, hey, I got all these things right before their sell-by date. I dropped by this afternoon. Maybe not. Maybe it's not that that something that you really brag about. So we think that distribution is only going to be an 8 out of 10. Of course, it's something you'll tell your close friends about, but it's not something where you're going out of your way to advertise it. Product market fit just makes sense. Gave it a 9 out of 9. Market size, groceries are enormous, and obviously it's a huge category, but just the things that are about to hit their sell-by date, that is a subset, a pretty small subset, so we gave it a 9. And then beyond that, it is 10s all the rest of the way, because they don't touch the food. They're just working with the grocery store. So it's just 10 for gross margin, 10 for organic scalability, 10 for op scalability, which produces an overall score of 84. Very 84. Solid.
So yeah, after 10s all the way down, we get to an 84, and that is Island. We've done 5, and we have we're about to do Island. We have 4 left. So an Island is next. Thank you to Flash Food for making the world a better place. Chris, I'll let you describe it. I'll just describe the round. It's a Series A that's $100 million. So this is an outsized Series A. And can you just tell us what Island's up to?
So this is a brilliant, brilliant idea. So when we think about cybersecurity, what is always the limiting factor of cybersecurity? It is not, do you put the right firewalls in place? Do you harden the defenses and all these things? The biggest problem is always your dumbass users. And there is no greater vector of bad things to happen with your dumbass users than the web browser itself. because they'll go to a website, they'll have these pop-ups. Do they know whether it's in the safe area or the not safe area? They click on something, they store all their passwords to log in to all your tools like Salesforce.com. They don't want to remember the password, so they just save it in their browser, which is terribly unsafe. All these things are big, big problems, and what the hell can you do about them, right? The users are going to do what they're going to do. Well, not anymore. Island is an enterprise secure browser. It's based on Chromium, which means it has the same functionality as Chrome, so it's no skin off other people's back to use it. And it basically is the browser you use when you're doing work stuff. So when you're logging into Salesforce, when you're logging into the accounting package, when you're logging into all these different tools, which are super important to the enterprise. Now, people are still going to have Chrome or Safari on their computer. They're still going to go and visit their various websites. They're going to go to Facebook on Chrome, and they're going to go to Twitter on Safari and whatnot. And that's fine, because the key information, the passwords, all these different things are being protected because people are going through Island. And I think that it makes a ton of sense. And the reason why I gave it high scores is, is it winner take most? Yeah, because it becomes a default. It becomes the thing that everyone does. Enterprise cybersecurity often works that way. Is there viral growth or distribution? Well, yeah, you got to battle it out for the individual accounts. But A, this is something that every cybersecurity expert would want. And B, the company can just mandate that people use it. They could probably even figure out a way to say, well, you can only access these internal systems through Island. Product market fit, look, it's a Series A, it's still early. Does it actually do all the things it's supposed to do? Unknown. We gave it an 8. But everything else, market size, gross margin, scalability, that's a 10 out of 10 because every company needs this. And it is a brilliant, brilliant idea.
I know. And if you'd ask me just off the cuff, so Scott, do you think the world needs another browser, or are there enough browsers in the world? It's like the world does not need another browser. I would have laughed at you, and I would have been wrong. This is exactly what the world needs, not the world, but the enterprise needs. And so a very deserved 84. And if you want to learn more about Island, you can go to island.io. And next we have Prior Auth Now. PRIORAUTHNOW. And you may have guessed, if you are a user of healthcare services in the United States, that this is about prior authorization. And if you go and get care without prior authorization, then the insurance company will not pay for it at all. And that has happened to me once, and I had to go and plead and beg for forgiveness, which I was eventually granted. But it is a really terrible process, and it takes a long time. And if you urgently need care and the insurance company's dragging their feet saying, oh, well, we don't really think Chris needs to have that, whatever, then, and so we're not going to cover it. A, it can, at best, it's an inconvenience, and at worst, it threatens a health outcome. So thank goodness this company exists. They got a $25 million Series C. A Series C for $25 million, not that big. So maybe we're seeing a trend. Insight Partners is the fund that led this round, and it is priorauthnow.com, and it's out of Columbus, Ohio. Oh, by the way, Island was Dallas, Texas, in case anyone's wondering about that. Now, we liked the winner take most aspect of this business. And it's just a natural winner take most thing, right? So if you have all the insurance companies and all the payers and all the people in the ecosystem signing on and looking at the same source of truth and communicating through the same communications channel, then it's just easier for everybody. And so having more than one makes absolutely no sense. You want to have a single source for all of this. And if Prior Auth Now is enabling that and becomes the single source, then that's an enormously powerful position for them, and it should be a super valuable business. Now, of course, if they don't win, then just like any other blitzscaler, then it's just, it's probably not worth much. So it sort of reminds me of, you're sitting at the poker table and you decide to go all in. So all in is sort of a blitzscaling strategy. And if you're bluffing, then it's a dangerous game. Anyway, so that's winner take most 10. And then for viral growth, well, not so much, right? I mean, sure, people will tell each other about this. It's not a zero, you know, and once they gain momentum as the standard, then, you know, it's a Series C. Maybe they've already gained momentum as the standard, but you're still selling to healthcare and that's a long sales cycle and it's expensive. So we're going to give that a 7. So 10 and a 7 is a tough start. So you better get good scores the rest of the way. And they did. So product market fit, we gave a 9 again. We've been pretty hot on these products recently. Usually we're around 8 or 7, but this is Series C and this is such a glaring need that should be solved that we stepped up with a 9 here. Market size, US healthcare market is you know, second maybe to the food market, or maybe it's bigger than food. I don't know. It's just huge. And this is a small piece of it, but still it's a 10. It's essentially unbounded. Gross margins, 10, scalability, 10, upscalability, 10. So we end up with an 82, and that's an awesome score. And I'm so glad this exists because I had a really bad experience in one of many terrible experiences with the US healthcare system. This was one of the worst.
You know, one of the things that strikes me, this is a brief sidebar, is as we look over these scores, it sort of divides up into these four major tranches. The first is blitz scalability, winner take most, and viral growth and distribution. Those are so critical. The last is the gross margin, org scalability, ops scalability, where the trio often for any internet software-based business is going to get a 10 out of 10. And what it means is that you've got these two other things, product market fit and market size. And so it's not enough to say, oh, I just want to have a software company. It has to be a software company with a great product, with a huge market, and then you can layer on at the end of that the blitz scalability as well. That's where you get the huge value from. So blitz scalability, software market, product market fit, market size. If you have all those things, you're going to be successful.
Yeah, and particularly if there's viral growth. That's why social networks tend to just crush it, and we have one of those at the end that we'll talk about. But for now, let's move on from prior auth now and talk about Heygo, H-E-Y-G-O, as in, hey, let's go somewhere. And Northzone led this round. Northzone is a top fund out of Norway in the Nordics, and they scored an 87. This is a Series A, $20 million, and they've only raised $22 million to date. So this is just the first, you know, first money they got after their $2 million seed round. And it's out of London. It's heygo.com, H-E-Y-G-O.com. And in here, we also have Lightspeed. So once again, we see Lightspeed reaching across the pond to put some money to work. They are one of our more active international investors based in Silicon Valley. All right. What's Heygo do? Chris, I talked about prior auth now. It's your turn. Let's talk about Heygo.
Absolutely. So what Heygo does is they're essentially tackling the virtual experiences element of Airbnb and focusing just on that. They allow people to be guides around the world that will take you as a tour group on this sort of live streaming platform. So you can see, you know, the sites in their hometown or what have you. And what's really interesting and brilliant about this is they take a tip-based business model. Now, what does that mean? It means that there is no charge for doing a Heygo tour. You don't have to pay anything, but you are encouraged to tip. It's a social expectation that people will tip somewhere between 2 to 5 euros, which is about $2 to $5 for attending one of these things. And so if you're a tour guide, you can get 100 people for a 30-minute tour and get 200 to 500 euros. That's pretty good. And the thing is, the tip-based factor makes it so low friction. Right. If you're like, oh, I don't know. Do I really want to pay for this? I'm not sure about it. Guess what? There's no risk. You don't have to pay anything if you don't like it. And that's probably what's been driving its growth. So winner take most market, yes, because you've got this list of tour guides who are essentially like the hosts on Airbnb. Viral growth or distribution, yes, because we just sort of described how it is a freemium approach, which really makes it easier to spread. And of course, if you're going on a tour, you want to go on a tour with your friends. You're going to tell other people. So there's a very natural vector for that to happen. We gave it a 9 out of 10 on that. And then we go into the other areas. Product market fit. Hey, it's still early. Is the experience really going to be there? We gave it an 8 out of 10. I still need to actually try one of these tours to find out. We reserve the right to increase that. Market size. Yeah, virtual sightseeing could be large, but is it really unbounded? You know what? I think people prefer seeing things in person if they can. It's just we have a pandemic going on right now, and so there's still a lot of virtual stuff. Maybe people do it as a way of getting to know a place before they go there. Still, more of a niche than just broader travel like Airbnb is tackling overall hospitality. This is not quite that. And then, of course, the holy trinity of software, gross margin, org scalability, ops scalability, 10 out of 10. That gives it a total score of 87. And just a little bit of a human interest story. I went on to see some of the things that were going on in Hago. And one of the things was a tour guide in Ukraine, somebody who had been a tour guide in Kyiv and was actually doing tours as she was retreating and escaping the country. And these tours were enormously popular. Thousands of people were tuning in because they're so curious about what's going on there and donating large amounts of money because they want to be helpful. Similar to that strange movement of people booking Airbnbs in Ukraine in order to get money to the various hosts. Kind of a strange way of doing it, but this is a little more direct and it actually creates that personal connection. So, thought that was a fascinating human interest story, a great side of why this is so powerful. I've always said live creates more emotional engagement than recorded. And I think Hago is really leveraging that.
Yeah, I just want to add to your talk, your argument for winner take most, which is if you're somebody who gives these tours, you're not going to bother to do it if it's only four people. You know, four people giving you $2, is that really worth the hour it took you to give them a tour of the underground in Paris or whatever? You know, it's just not worth your while. So you want to go to the one where it's the largest audience. So when you actually bother to do your tour, there's 20 or 30 people, and you can actually make it worth your while. So it's really important that you have the largest audience possible. And so the biggest one is going to have the most tour guides, and therefore it's going to have the biggest audience because the audience also wants to have the most choice in where they can go and have their virtual tour. And I think the use case is beyond people who, you know, just want to preview something. I think there are places in the world where I'll probably never really book a trip and go there, honestly. And yet I'm curious, you know, what it's like and would love to check it out in a way that's not just, you know, sort of poking around on a Google Street View. So it's certainly something that is early in its use case proof and integration into how people travel, but now that everybody's really used to doing things virtually, it seems like a good time for these guys to get going. So we're gonna definitely watch this one carefully. And the score's an 87, so it's a really high score and something that we're gonna take seriously. And last but not least is a seed deal called Portal Labs. And this one is sprouting out of Greylock, and it scores a whopping 93 because it gets 10 out of 10 for winner take most and viral growth. And Chris is going to tell us why, what they do, and why they get such an amazing score in those two important elements.
Well, what Portal Labs does is it offers a very easy in the browser metaverse. Now, the word metaverse, it almost makes me feel with dread when I hear it because it's being used in all these crazy, strange ways. What essentially Portal Labs is doing is they're creating a browser-based metaverse where you can interact with others, you can interact with your environment. It's got a very Minecraft or Robloxy kind of aesthetic. But you know what happens is you have this virtual world, what we would call, you know, honestly a 3D world, but an isometric world where you're moving around in it with your game character, and then you can interact with various things, interact with various screens, play various games, and so on and so forth. Now, is this very different from all these other attempts to build metaverses? Not really. Right? That's why this is a measurement of the opportunity in many cases rather than the company itself. Is a metaverse a winner take most market? Yes, because people want to go where their friends are. People want to go where the people they want to meet are. Is there viral growth or distribution? There does tend to be, because again, you want to go to stuff together. And you want to tell people about, if you build up your own space in the metaverse, you want folks to come visit. So that's all great. We ding this very heavily on product market fit because this is so freaking early. And, metaverse, let's put it this way. I mean, the Roblox is a metaverse. Minecraft is a metaverse. Why do we need a new metaverse? Is it going to have the product market fit for casual interaction in the same way that it does for just interacting with the environment? Still unknown. But the thing that makes the metaverse so promising is it could be the way that we interact with people in the future. So that makes it a 10 out of 10 market. And it's online, it's software. So it's got the holy trinity of gross margin, org scalability, and ops scalability. That means that it is getting 10 out of 10 in every category except for product market fit. And that's a 93. But if it does have product market fit, if it really takes off, it can be absolutely enormous in the way that a Roblox or a Minecraft is. But how the hell do you know if it's going to be the one that actually takes off? That's the $1 billion question.
But Chris, it's built on the blockchain. Doesn't that automatically make it Web3 and therefore just this thing that's going to absolutely happen for sure and is the way of the future?
Without a doubt, absolutely.
Okay, so we have reached the end now. Originally, we were going to talk about one other deal that didn't make the cut, Avant Art. And do you want to mention that briefly before we sign off?
Sure. So Avant Art is an interesting one to talk about. It's basically a marketplace business for fine art, and it's for unique pieces, also for limited edition prints and all that sort of thing. And the reason it's interesting to bring this up as a topic is you would say, well, it's a two-sided marketplace, and therefore, doesn't it just mean it's going to sail on through and it's going to be blitz scalable? And the answer is, well, it really depends on the dynamics of the individual transactions. You've heard me talk before about transaction size, transaction consideration, selection. And you would think, well, hold on, isn't this going to work out really well? Because art, the transactions are relatively large, it's relatively high consideration, the selection really matters. So why are you telling me that this is something that is not necessarily blitz scalable? And the answer is, interestingly enough, uniqueness and the desire for uniqueness tends to cause issues with the marketplace itself. So when you buy fine art, you're trying to buy something that is unique. You definitely want to get something that is just available to you. Whereas in Airbnb, you can stay in a unique property, but then somebody else can stay there the next week. And so there's a constant ability to cycle through that. Whereas with something like Avant Art, okay, here's a piece of art. How do I know how much it's worth? How do I know that it is going to be something that is, really unique to me? Well, they promised me that it's unique. Okay, great. Well, I buy it. How do I know what price to pay? And of course, this is still a good thing, right? The world of art has all these problems, even if they're not in a marketplace. At least having it in a marketplace where you can see all the different works, where you can read about the artists, is better than just going to some random gallery and thinking, well, I don't know if the stuff here is the best stuff or if there's better stuff across the city. So it absolutely helps the art market. But then the dynamics of the art market itself, the desire to buy these unique items, it makes it really difficult to price, makes it really difficult to decide, okay, this is something I want to do.
So it's that uniqueness, the fact that you can't sell. I mean, there's these great Airbnb properties and you get to sell them over and over and over and over and over again. And there's established market for it and everybody understands it. And it's got reviews and people feel comfortable that other people have reviewed it well. And it makes the purchase online really easy. And that's missing with Avant Art. And so that's, you're just saying that it's a tougher purchase to make and you can't sell it over and over again because it's unique. And that's what knocked it out of the running.
Correct. And again, it just goes to show you, we are not just saying, oh, blindly, yeah, it's a two-sided marketplace, therefore it's blitz scalable. We are looking at the actual transactions that are going on. It's all fine and dandy to have rules of thumb, but you always have to get down to the level of the individual details and decide, okay, does this work or does this not?
And therein lies the art. And so we're hoping that this podcast helps you really understand those nuances. And this has been a lot of fun as usual.
Thank you, Scott. As always, we will be back in a month to look at the upcoming venture deals that are being announced as we speak here in the month of March 2022. And until then, I hope you guys are enjoying the start of spring, that you are finding some awesome deals out there. And Scott and I will look forward to speaking with you again in a month.